Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we have John Hoyer back on the show. John is the reigning Angler of the Year of the NWT in 2023, and he came into the 2024 season. The first stop was in April here, just a few days ago as we were recording this, but over on Lake Erie, and John won it. He's obviously on a roll right now, fishing with a ton of confidence, and we're going to get right into this interview because we're talking all about this Lake Erie tournament, but a couple things I want to say is some of the most entertaining and educational content out there that is free of charge and easy to access is John's social media. I mean, if you want to learn or be entertained by some of the highest level guys in walleye fishing, John ought to be one of them. Follow the social media on Facebook and Instagram. And the other thing, and we don't even mention it here in this interview, we don't talk about it, but on YouTube, the YouTube series Tour Level Gold, they'd had their first season last year. Many of you probably seen it. If you didn't, you know, go look it up and binge watch last year. The access that you get to these guys, you're not going to find it anywhere else like this. Access to like John and his buddies, and it sounds like there's a few new characters this year, which is going to be really great, but just getting that kind of access behind the scenes and you know, the series covers these guys while they're pre-fishing for these big NWT tournaments, and it follows through the weigh-ins, and it really just tells this whole story of these guys through these tournaments. And again, I mean, it's really great information. It's entertaining and very educational, and to see these guys in their natural element of fishing and seeing their reactions and how they do things and just the stories to go with it is just, you know, the education and entertainment that you're just not going to get access to anywhere else like it. So let's get into it. I got John Hoyer, walleye fishing. Let's do it. This episode is brought to you by Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations. And to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description. John, I really, really appreciate the time. It's you're driving away from the shores of Lake Erie right now. You just won the first stop of the NWT 2024. After this win, what do you have to say for yourself right now?
I have no idea what to say, honestly. It's been really blurry the last few years for me. As far as I just put dates on the calendar, I get the excitement of anticipating like when practice is going to start. The first one's at Lake Erie. That one's going to be tough for me. I'm not good at trolling. And then just, 7 days fly by. We're day one of the tournament. I'm excited. I'm calm, but I'm a little anxious. And then, I'm in third. And then go out day two. Zero butterflies at all. It's going to be super windy. Oh my gosh. I just upgraded a 9-pounder for like a 4-pounder. And then, you know, like it doesn't even really resonate for me, honestly.
I mean, you said something there like, I'm not really good at trolling. Like, I feel like you're selling yourself short there, because a few short years ago, forward sonar wasn't really a thing. And you fished on a high level then too. Like, when you say you're not good at trolling, are you just sort of like self-deprecating there, or do you really believe that you've casted so much lately that you forgot how to troll?
No, I mean, I've done a lot of fun trips to Erie in the last 10 years. I mean, it was love at first sight when I first started fishing here, you know, traveling with Bill and Corey and Dusty. And the trolling thing is like, if you're going to troll, Lake Erie's the place to do it, you know, especially for big fish. And, you know, I have confidence in trolling, but I just can't help, but I'm just naturally observant. So like when I'm in a pack of boats, you know, it's very rare that I have the best catch rate. So now let's whittle that down to 140 of the best anglers in the world, Lake Erie anglers. And it's like, I'm a realist. To win a trolling tournament when we're all using big crankbaits, it's like, what are the odds? You know, the odds for me are like 1%. And if I would have trolled, I can tell you how my trolling went. My best days, I maybe would have had 25, 26 pounds. So that's kind of where I'm at. Yes, I know how to troll for sure. Yes. But is that a recipe to win a tournament? No, not in my world. I don't think so. It would take way more luck than skill.
Yeah, no, I definitely just wanted to hit you with that there because I feel like there's a lot of us listening where trolling is maybe our strength, but we wouldn't even be able to talk trolling with you. So it's like, but no, man, no, I like that. I think that's a really fair. I think that's a really fair way to look at it, right? That those are some of those big conversations that we have nowadays going into tournaments. And we talk about you and you know, we talk about Dewey and everybody that, you know, is out there casting versus trolling. Like, can Forward Sonar, you know, do this again? I think Forward Sonar gets a lot of the credit, but the reality is Forward Sonar is just like an inanimate object in our boats. Like, I think it take, you know, the operator, I think, has a lot to do with it. But that being said, I want to talk about Erie. I know that, you know, you've done some interviews, you know, like NWT, if anybody that pays attention probably, you know, saw the weigh-ins or has seen it by now. I kind of want to hear a little bit more about on the tournament side of things. I've never fished Lake Erie. Everything about it is interesting to me, right? Like, if I look on the outside looking in, it just looks like it's full of big fish and they must be just jumping in the boat. And then, you know, all the big talk about the weather out there that seems so intimidating. I kind of want to dig into some of those things. Like, is there really that many big fish out there? How tough the conditions get and what it was like for you to cast during this tournament and be effective at it. You know, I find those topics to be interesting. So where do we have to start there? I feel like Lake Erie itself and how logistics of, like, you know, do you make the big long runs in the big boat? Do you, you know, like all those stories, where do we have to start here to sort of describe what it's like to fish a tournament in tough conditions on Lake Erie?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the important geographical things about Lake Erie is, you know, you hear the Western Basin. So the Western Basin is a lake that's, you know, that part of the lake is, I don't know, three times bigger than Lake of the Woods, maybe four times bigger than Lake of the Woods. So it's barely a basin at all. You know, it's a freaking huge lake. And that's fed by the Detroit River on the northwest corner of it, the Maumee River on the southwest corner, and then kind of east central Western Basin is what they call the reef area. So there's like 99% of spawning on Lake Erie happens either in the Detroit River, the Maumee River, or on the reefs. So the one thing that we joke about in camp, and it's kind of degrading a little bit because it's human nature, you know, to have a good day on day one on Erie maybe, and then, you know, you hear it sometimes and it's kind of laughable, but it's like our fish moved. So I like to laugh about that because when you're fishing around the Bass Islands, where it's kind of the gateway to the Western Basin, and you're talking, I think, 250 million walleyes in the lake right now, of which I would say 15% of those fish are those tourney grade ones, those like 6 to 8 pounders. So when you hear somebody say our fish moved, they're talking about a school that could have been 3 miles long by a mile wide. And to talk like you have those fish tagged on day one, you're on the school of big ones and you weighed 40 pounds near Kelly's Island and then your fish moved, but you relocated them 3 miles away. Like, that's so vague and random. It's not what's going on. There's literally fish going in every direction at all times. The spawn starts in, like, this year it started in early March with a little bit of a warming trend. There's still pre-spawners in the system. And if it's only 10% of the fish that haven't spawned yet, we're talking like 20 million walleyes that haven't spawned yet. So they're everywhere. They're going every direction. They're all on different schedules. Some of the early ones that have spawned are all the way back past Cleveland on their way to their summer home. Another 50 million walleyes that have already spawned, they're going to hang out, you know, in the Western Basin or by Huron, you know, for another month and a half. So they're literally everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's like a 35-pound bag. And that was really key for me, my past experience on Lake Erie, and that generalization of, like, I'm not married to a spot at all. I don't care where I fish this tournament. I just simply need to find fishable water. And when you talk about, everybody was talking about water clarity, leading into the tournament. And it's the key thing. And the reason why it's such a hot topic is simply because the Western Basin is only like 30 feet deep. If you get rain, the Miami River is going to dump chocolate milk, unfishable water into the Western Basin. If you get wind, the entire basin is going to dirty up, and it's going to be, you know, borderline unfishable. Unfishable means the walleyes just simply can't see your lures, and your odds go down so far that your catch rate is almost, you know, nothing. So going into that tournament, that was one of the relaxing parts of me. It was a little stressful because I didn't have that mother load, you know, out on the east side of Kelly's where they're all 8-pounders and it's always clear water. I didn't have that spot. So I just knew that there was enough fish that are still coming to spawn around the reefs. I had seen that in practice the last 2 days, that I'm just going to get, I'm going to start driving north out of the launch. The second I start coming into a little bit of a green tint, I'm going to slow down. I'm going to start marking fish on plane. And when I mark some big ones, I'm going to start fishing. And that's exactly what happened day one.
I follow a lot of the NWT guys, and hearing everybody's story of like water clarity, they're all kind of preaching the same thing, but they all have their own decisions to make and or justifications. You know, some people are talking about finding the right water. They had to make these, you know, they decided that they had to make these long runs to these fish, but then that's such a risk because, you know, you might make this long run slow in these big waves because you guys had weather, you know, the conditions are such a big factor, and I kind of want to tie that in, but like, what are they talking about, and what are some of those decisions? Like, how do you make those decisions, you know, in a big tournament, going into a big tournament on Erie?
Yeah, I'll be honest, you know, when I think back at what I just said and the way you described it, you know, I don't want to degrade anybody who made those long runs. Hindsight's 20/20, and the reality of it is I was looking for 30 pounds a day, to just position myself for the angler of the year. You know, I knew I could maybe top 10 with 60 pounds and I'd have to look, but yeah, that would for sure be a top 10, I believe. You know, when it was all said and done. So, I wasn't going into this tournament like I can completely win it. My practice, you know, I had some 30 pound bags in practice and I was doing exactly what I did in the tournament. But when I decided to just find that fishable water and give myself maximum fishing time, really that plan was just based around, I'm sure some troller guy found a big school that's already fattened up. They spawned a month and a half ago over by Avon or Lorain or even Cleveland, and they're going to have a 40 pound day. But if I can get 30 pounds a day close to home around the reefs, you know, I'll be fine with that. I could even, you never know, I could even top five with 60 pounds. So I don't want to sound like, you know, the guy who's saying those long runs aren't worth it. I've done some very long runs on Lake Erie. And when you find what you're looking for, you gotta make that decision. You gotta weigh the odds. Can I get it done in 3 hours of fishing? What happens if it gets really windy? I only have 2 hours of fish. Well, you better be pretty dialed because I've been in that scenario before and I've made that run with the confidence that yes, I can get it done in 2 hours and it's stressful. But you need to be locked and loaded and ready for that situation, especially when the day two weather report rolled out. Those guys that made those, you know, even 25 mile runs to the east downwind, knowing that they're going to have to go back into it. Those guys are very confident, and I know that feeling, and it's almost, you almost get a little hint of insanity where you're like, is this the right decision? Because it's really hard to just go and fish, you know, somewhere, an area that you never practice in and just go there confidently. But the beauty of it was I fished around the reefs probably 3 days, and, you know, there was plenty of big ones around there. So that's where I was I was confident that I could probably pick through and find, you know, 30 pounds a day around the reefs, and 25 at the absolute worst, you know, would be, there's no way we're not catching 25 pounds a day.
And talking specifically about those conditions, I kind of want to have you describe what Lake Erie was like, you know, like during pre-fish and even on tournament day. Because when you're weighing those decisions of like, am I going to go 40 miles? Am I going to go 60? Am I going to go 80 miles? What are you really contemplating? I think a lot of people probably know what it's like to bust some pretty big waves for a couple miles back to the boat ramp on their own home lake. But like to contemplate a long run on Lake Erie in those conditions, I think a description of that would definitely kind of paint that picture.
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And until I started fishing the Great Lakes, I didn't know that. And, you know, I grew up in, okay, it got rough, sit down and hang on. And bless my dad, he was never taught by a professional angler, but I'll never forget a day on Mille Lacs when Jim Carroll told me at like 5 p.m. we're going to go out to the mud flats from the gravel on the southeast corner. We were in like 3 to 4 footers. It was windy out of the northwest. And I'm like, we're going out to the mud now? And he's like, yeah. And I'm back there. I guarantee you I was white knuckling the rail on the side of his boat getting ready for this run. And then he puts it on plane and he just drives like 15 miles an hour into these waves, kind of quarters into them. So like from that day forward, he told me straight up, it's never worth running your boat hard enough where you'll even break, even loosen a screw. If you to break anything, making a run back to weigh in, the only way you'd ever do that is if you knew for sure you had the tournament winning bag and something came up or the wind, it got windier, unforeseen, you know, where you had to really drive a boat. But the reality is, when it gets windy like that, let alone, you know, waves that are touching a small craft advisory, that's like, if I'm going into them, that's like 12 miles an hour. I'm literally touching my throttle. I'll get tendonitis from how often I'm touching my throttle. Every single wave is calculated. I will power up on top of the big sets. I'll come off the throttle and slide down with my nose up down the back one. I'll hit the throttle again to get on top of the next one. This is all slow motion, 10, 12 miles an hour, maybe 15 or 20 if I want to get my bow down in between the big sets, and I'll stay on top of those with my nose down and just absorb all those. I'll come to the next set. I'll back way off. You know, I call it safety mode. The other calculations you can do, let's say there's a big straight west wind. Guess what? I was driving straight north. That's a godsend right there. If you can trough them, you know, with our beautiful boats, I run a Ranger 621. If I can trough them, like on my way in, going directly parallel to these 3, 4, 5, even 6 foot waves, I can average 30 miles an hour. And that's a lot of throttle too, but I'm surfing down the big ones. I'm starting to climb back over the little ones. I'm surfing down the big ones. So it's a really active way that we drive our boats on the Great Lakes. And it's definitely a very key thing, you know, to get to your spot. Don't have your coingler all rattled up. You're not rattled up. Nobody's injured. Nobody's, you know, scared. You got to take what the lake gives you and realize that, yes, that is a huge factor in time. But the most important part is that you get there, everything works, everybody's in tip-top working shape, and it's time to get to work. You got a shortened clock now, and you know it's going to take even longer to get back in. So definitely a key part for strategizing in a Great Lakes tournament.
I think that's very educational, you know, for those of us that either just aren't proficient at that, don't have a lot of experience, or have never really experienced it, and just follow tournament fishing. When we hear that, you know, that sort of story being told, or, you know, or you just hear those little blurbs on social media or on YouTube, or you're watching the weigh-ins and, you know, somebody talks about it being wavy out there and I didn't get to go to my first spot, or I didn't do this or do that because it was too wavy. Like, that's really what that's what you're contemplating. I mean, 10, 12 miles an hour on these epically long runs, I mean, that'll just wear a guy out. Not everybody can physically do that. Plus your equipment. And I kind of want to get into that. I know, like, you're sponsored by Zipwake. That's a specific product that I don't get no money from Zipwake, but I would really like to hear about what that does when it comes to just the safety and control of being in those conditions. I think that we would be a disservice if we didn't describe some of that stuff, because I think having the right equipment is a big part of this conversation as well. We're not trying to like describe this or teach people how to do this so they can go out in their 16 foot tiller and do this. I mean, the equipment is important.
Yeah, for sure. So Zipwake is a complete, when I put my first Zipwake on my Ranger boat like 4 years ago, I said, I'll never own another boat without it. And, you know, day-to-day usage where, let's say we're not on the Great Lakes, but we're with three people in the boat and we got a live well full of minnows on Leech Lake or something like that. Like, regardless of how I pack my boat, there's going to be times where things change, or, you know, again, when I'm troughing those waves, I got them hard on my starboard side. You know, I might be getting a little splash if it's blowing 20. So, first and foremost, the zip wake allows me to use the little dial to drop the intersectors on the back, you know, left or right of the transom of my boat. And I can just tilt my boat left or right. So I can drive, I'm going to drive 5 miles on Leech Lake and I'm going to be quartering into the waves. I'm going to dip the front left of my bow down. A, it's going to keep my bow from being able to rise up as far, therefore having higher potential to slap harder on a wave so I can keep a little more speed. B, I'm going to tilt my boat to the left so there's going to be, you know, 90% less splashing because now my gunwale is so much higher on the right. But when I get into the really big stuff and I got a live well full of walleyes and, you know, I'm even going, you know, quartering straight into 4 or 5 footers, I'll put them both down a little bit. And again, that just allows my bow to recover. I can slide down the back of those waves. You got to be careful not to overdo it because you could put them down at 100 and then it would want to like spear a wave. But, you know, 30% or whatever, there's just so much adjustment I can do with that system. It allows me to go into like a saltwater mode and literally have my entire route perfectly dialed. Like I'll just play with it a little bit, play with it a little bit. Okay, now I'm perfect. Now all I got to touch is my throttle. I'm trimmed all the way down and it's just on and off the throttle for every big set of waves. And yeah, they're amazing. It's an amazing system to run on your boat. If you're on anything, you know, bigger than Lake Mille Lacs, Leech Lake, anywhere, or you got a lot of people in your boat at times, they're the ultimate for boat control. The other thing you can do too is if you get like 4 people, 4 big guys in your boat and your live well is full and you're trying to go and plane into like 2 to 3 footers, put them both down 100%. It literally drives your boat down and allows you to get on plane 50% faster.
Yeah. See, I feel like this is the perfect place to do good gear reviews like that, you know, because it's, you know, it's a huge part of the story when we're talking about decision making in a tournament. Even a non-tournament angler that's going out fishing, you know, the, you know, just the safety and, you know, keeping your gear right and tight. But like I think some of those gear recommendations, you know, talking about the, you know, the big boats and the big motors, I mean, we have to be able to talk about that stuff, and it's not just about trying to sell that stuff. Definitely, I think it plays a big factor for sure. So
there's only one negative, Taylor, I'll be honest, and that some of your listeners are going to roll their eyes, and rightfully so. But when you have the Ranger 621 FS Pro with zip wake, a 400 horse Mercury V10 Verado, and then you can also throw in Dakota lithium batteries for your trolling motor. The only downfall of that is you literally have no excuses at all.
Yeah.
There's no excuses not to be out there. Like you can't, you know, you want to suck your thumb all day and stay in bed because it's windy and you don't want to go out fishing. But guess what? Like I had multiple people ask me on day 2 at the tournament as we're idling to the launch area. And they're like, you think they're going to send us today, John? And oh my gosh, was I ready for that question? And I said, I hope so. And then I got to see their face and it was like, oh man, he has a completely different attitude than I do. And then even my one friend, Ryan Rieger, who he asked me, and it was, we're buddies. So he's like, do you think they're going to send us today? And I said, I hope so. And he kind of was like, didn't expect that answer. And I go, how do you like that answer, Ryan? He goes, I love it. So, you know, there's no excuses. And, that's kind of the beauty of a tournament. There's going to be people that, you know, might not have the exact dream rig that I have. You know, every fiberglass boat is amazing, but you know, they're already getting anxious about the conditions and they don't want to fish in it. And I don't want to fish in it, but I'm not going to let my brain think that way. So, you'll see it, you know, when we get days like day 2 on Lake Erie, those weights are going to flip flop. And a lot, you know, there's a percentage of the field that, you know, might have already had themselves beat. They already were going through excuses of why it was going to be nearly impossible on day 1. And you know what? As a competitor, that's like maybe one of the only times I get competitive because I would not let my brain go down that route. It's going to suck, and I'm going to love it.
This episode is brought to you by Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations. And to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description. That brings me back. I had a conversation with Jason Shakir. I know he's a buddy of yours. I had a couple of years back, and we were talking a lot about this topic of like big wind, you know, how to fish in big blows. And he made that point as well that, you know, on a big blow or just real tough conditions, whatever they are, it usually just takes half of the field out of the equation. And that's not trying to be disrespectful or nothing. It's just in his experience, that's just what it does. And as a competitor, those are those days that you really like. Those are the days that you're sponsored for. Those are the days that your sponsors want you to have, you know, because that's where it really, you know, a lot happens there, and we can take a lot out of that. And that's a great pivot. I want to pivot into that a little bit. And, you know, talking about this tournament specifically, day two, you had some serious conditions, right? Everybody's experiencing them, but everybody already had day one under their belt. So now there's new calculations going on. How are we going to do this? How are we going to salvage? Or, you know, guys that are up top like you, it's like, how am I going to capitalize on this? Like, and the conditions change. You know, it seemed like from what I heard, day two was way tougher than day one, weather-wise or, you know, conditions-wise. And, you know, notoriously now, I mean, you were out there, you know, going into day two, everybody knows you were jigging. So that's the big question. Can John or anybody that's jigging, can anybody even do it in that kind of conditions where you're trolling motors out of the water? Like I want to hear kind of that version of the story, the day two of Lake Erie, and just how you're out there doing it, how you're even able to go out there and do it. You know, as much of day two that I can hear about, I would love it.
Yeah. Well, the weigh-in, or if anyone watched the weigh-in, didn't get the gist of it or heard the wind on the microphones, it was absolutely biblical. And I commend the NWT for sending us, because the next day was even windier. And, you know, the reality of it is if we didn't go on day two, it would have been a one-day tournament. And, you know, I just don't feel like it's really – there's always kind of an asterisk on a one-day tournament. You know, we're fishing for $100,000. Everybody wants a chance to move up. There's guys that are going to move up and make adjustments after day one. You know, those are the guys that are generally on average successful. They deserve a second shot. You know, the guys in the lead that were close. And when I was talking to my friends, I'm like, sweet. Well, if they don't send us tomorrow, they're definitely not sending us Saturday. And that would mean I took third place of the first tournament. Yep, I'm fine with that. Double blow day. But also, like I said, I wouldn't let my mind go down that. I was joking about it, but like, I have a chance to win this tournament. And so when we went out, it was like this eerie, no pun intended, calm, kind of confused waves. Like there was a wet thunderstorm that had even gone through the night before. And it was like a checkerboard of waves, but it was calm. It was like zero wind. And I started driving out, and I was probably like 2 miles away from where I caught most of my fish on day one, and 3 miles actually. And I found this pod and I was like, oh my gosh. And I knew the water was dirty, but I started there. And sure enough, I got some big ones. I got my jig and fluke in front of some big ones, and they moved on it and they didn't bite, just like day one, just like all practice. They were not biting the first couple hours of the morning. But I laid a couple waypoints down, and all of a sudden the wind went like 20, 30, maybe even gust of 40 straight out of the west. And I knew I needed to get into a little bit cleaner water, and I wanted to do it before these waves are huge. And I kept fishing like another 10, 15 minutes. And then I'm like, all right, we got to get back on plane. And by the time I was on plane, the waves were already like for sure 3 footers, 2 to 3s, and building fast. And I started getting out into where I had some waypoints from day one, and like, yep, there's still a bunch of fish here, but where are the bigger ones? Okay, now it's like 4 footers. I still haven't set in again yet, but I'm like, okay, I got to start fishing. I marked like a couple nicer ones. I'm going to start adrift. And by the time I put my trolling motor in, I mean, it is nautical. And what happened was the first drift I did ended up being like a mile long, and a lot of that was like, I don't want to drive back into that stuff. I need to like get a decent limit here. and probably by the end of that drift, it was like maybe 9:30 or 10 a.m. I had about 25 pounds. So, I mean, that's a really good start. I'm like, well, sweet. We're at 25 pounds. Like, I'm going to probably cash a check. You know, that's a check. So then it's like, all right, we got to put her back on plane. We got to get back to the top of that drift. You know, I haven't seen a lot of big ones. And I got back up there. And I mean, this is again, like 8 to 10 miles an hour, just monster waves. And they're so close together on the Western Basin. It's a lot like Mille Lacs or Leech, not a deep basin. Therefore, the waves don't get spaced out. They're sharp. They're really close together. So probably 20 minutes to go a mile into those waves, maybe even 25. Mark a few fish again, start the next drift. I don't remember if it was that drift. I might have done a little short pass or it was the next one. But sure enough, here comes 11 a.m. when the big ones actually start biting. And I maybe had 1 6-pounder in my live well. And I get in the zone and I'm like, oh, my gosh, is that 4 big ones? And, you know, is that a big one on the bottom? Is that 4 up high? And it was so nautical. What ended up happening was I really started realizing, because this is the windiest I fished in, the waviest I fished in all of practice, and probably in my entire life, to be honest. But I started realizing, like, there's only a few casts I can make accurately. It's not so much like a quartering cast downwind. I want to go downwind to find big fish, but the reality was I had to turn right back into those things if I was going to make a really, really precise cast. And I know I probably never say enough about my Dakota Lithium batteries, but I had one little hint in the morning. Like, my trolling motor is on 10, and I am not letting off that foot pedal once I mark the fish I want, a 6-plus pounder. So inevitably, I would slip downwind to those fish, and then it would be like, you know, try to make the cast. And trolling motor out of the water, huge waves. When I would finally hook up, I was looking at the next waves coming. My co-angler would come up to the front. He was always kneeling in the front of the boat for safety because it was that rugged. I'm on the gas on the foot pedal. Otherwise, I would have been drifting back at like 2.5 miles an hour away from my fish. I want to get on top of that fish, get it to the surface, net it. And to be honest, the really cool part, which I'm hoping you'll be able to get to see on Tour Level Gold, is there was times I would hook big fish, like ones I wanted, within, call it like 7 waves of a big monster set of 5-footers. And I would literally lock that drag down and get that fish up to the surface. I'm like, we got to do it before the set. Get up here, get ready. Here we go. And I would literally, I had my drag almost cinched. And I literally get a 6 to even, one of them was like a 9-pounder, right up to the surface, trolling motor on 10, power right to the fish, and have the co-angler net it. He'd net it and basically go into like survival mode, get between the windshields, and here comes the freaking monsters.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody just make sure the fish isn't going to fall out of the boat. Brace yourself. Okay, now I'm in the back. Can't get an accurate weight on anything. Kind of eyeballing them. No point in trying to use a balance beam in those conditions. So it's just like this rough estimate. But without getting too long-winded, that was the system. Figure out what I could get away with. Make the cast, make enough casts in a day on the right fish, and was completely blessed with like 3 big bites, like a 7, an 8, and a 9-pounder.
Now, talking about what you can get away with, that's part of this too, because the way you describe it, like, and reality is, if nobody's in the boat, we're never going to truly get it. But I want to get as close as we can to that experience for you. You obviously have to make huge compromises, right? Versus ideal conditions for what you're trying to do from a fishing standpoint, you know, utilizing forward sonar. You're up on the foot pedal, you're up in the bow, you're locating fish. But in these conditions, you have to make massive sacrifices to just how it goes. How would you describe that?
Yeah. I mean, spearing waves, I mean, that was one huge thing. So, you know, if you watch bass guys, they'll fish in big wind. They're always going into waves. They're kind of funny like that, where, you know, we're used to drifting with the wind at our back. But, you know, nowadays I'm on the bow and I find myself, you know, especially when there is a tourney grade fish that I spotted. Well, now, what are my obstacles? Well, all those waves are definitely my obstacle. My accuracy, the current, the undertow, all that stuff is all a factor. So the reality is, like, where we're at nowadays in fishing, it's really amazing how amazing the human brain is, and how I can make a cast across the wind, berth it for a 5 foot drift, like a golf swing. I might hook it into the wind. It's going to drift 5 feet. The fish is moving right to left. There's an undertow, so I want to start it, you know, 5 or 10 feet left of it. And here we go. I think I might be close, and no. So you do that like 5 or 6 times, like, no, John, don't make that cast. You got to, like, I got to do something with my boat. I got to take a different angle on these waves. I need to try to make these fish, like, you know, I need to be able to try to hit my target. So, that was all, again, I mean, there's a learning curve, but that was exponential extreme. So it was all new to me, but the reality is we got to practice quite a bit in practice. That's like 20% more than anything I didn't practice, but it's just amazing how, your brain, whether it was practice pheasant hunting or, you know, leading something or whatever, it's like, it just amazes me what our brains can do. And, that was kind of the fun challenge of it. But the reality of it was, like, definitely lower your expectations for weight. Like, there's no way I can be as efficient. If it was flat calm on Erie, I literally could have caught like 200 fish a day. So down from there somewhere, I don't know how many I caught on day two, maybe only like 15, but I was being very picky. If I was going to pick my spot to potentially spear a wave by 3 foot, you know, it was going to be for a very valuable fish. And, those were kind of the things that I wasn't thinking about it, but like, that was what I was doing in hindsight.
What was the bite like? I mean, if you could, you know, put a bait in front of these fish, you know, if you made the right cast, was your batting average really high? Did your lure presentation or cadence have a huge factor in this? Like, for the bites you did get, especially the tourney grade bites that you got, you know, how would you describe the bite?
It was kind of like hour to hour. I mean, that 11 to 1 window was like high performance mode. A huge percentage of the fish would bite it if they could just see it. And I mean, I went through a lot of baits in practice, and, you know, I ended up using a 4-inch power minnow and then a 5-inch power bait jerk shad. And, you know, there's a lot of systems where, you know, a glide bait, there's a reason why a glide bait works so well. It's because, like, the profile of it is narrow, easy to inhale. Well, there's a lot of walleyes. Take Lake Oahe, where they'll swim 160 miles to get to where the smelt live in the summertime, because they are literally addicted to smelt. And a big part of that is how easy smelt are to digest, how easy they are to hit. You know, like, there isn't any hesitation there. So I actually figured that pattern out last year on a fun fishing trip. On the very last day, I caught like 8 fish and probably like an hour and a half or 2 hours, like tripled my trolling catch rate. And I joked with your boy Jason Shakirat about the amount of tackle that I was bringing for Lake Erie. All my crankbaits, deep hit sticks, flicker minnows, you know, competitor brands, bandits, husky jerks, you name it, everything. Normal hit sticks, perfect tens, just loads and loads of crankbaits. He said, choose wisely. You know, there isn't all those storage in the world in those Ranger boats. And I sent him a text. It was kind of cocky, but I was like, to be honest, I could fit my entire tackle box in the glove box, my Ranger.
Yeah.
And it was like a joke, but it wasn't. And he didn't know that. Like, I was 100% serious, but he was kind of like, ha ha, I hear you, or whatever. And, you know, if you watch any bass tournaments this spring, a lot of them are one doing the same exact thing. So, to answer your question, yes, when they were feeding, if you could get that bait in their strike zone, they were some of the most entertaining things. And I think that's lost in forward facing sonar. The sheer excitement and the ability that we have, you know, with a little bit of foot pedal control, to get to watch these fish eat baits and to realize where they rank on the food chain as far as predators, like, The only thing that compares is when a muskie destroys your bucktail out of nowhere, or it comes out of the water to eat your topwater. You know, we get to watch this 10, 15, 20, 25 feet down, and the moves that these fish do to absolutely inhale your bait, you can't help but giggle. You could be in 6-footers in a tournament, and it was still like your first reaction is like, oh my gosh. And oh, it saw it. Oh, my line went slack by 3 feet. I better set the hook. Wow, this is a giant. Like, those were the playful, fun things that were going through my head. And that was because when they locked onto that little minnow profile, it was either they're going to follow it and most of the time not bite it because they're just smart, especially the big ones. Like, if they got behind it and started following and stuff, rarely ever bite. But, you know, if you got into a situation where you brought it in over their head, or maybe you went past them to the bottom or whatever, like, if they were in a feeding mode and they locked onto that thing, it happened so fast. It was hilarious.
One thing, and this might, you know, I don't know, I would love to take up like 4 hours of your time, but that being said, this might be our last maybe topic to dig into, but I feel like, you know, gear recommendations or just some of the gear modifications, those are always big, good topics on here if we can address that. And I feel like fishing in those conditions, did you modify maybe your line selection for casting purposes, maybe the jig weight, maybe your rod selection for accurate casting? Like, what were some of the meaningful pieces of gear and their function that you felt really contributed to you getting bit?
I mean, yeah, that's kind of been a slow progression, but, you know, I used to use a lot of like 7.4s and 7.6s, and I realized that like a 7-footer rod wise is like about the longest I want to use for accuracy. But I still want a 7-footer instead of like a 6.8, 6.9, 6.10. I still want that for, especially when I'm using heavier stuff. So 3/8 or 1/2 ounce. And that's just because you need to move the line. You need to bury the hook. So, you know, my go-to for that presentation is a 7-footer. I found myself using shorter rods even, you know, when I'm using lighter stuff. And I actually use a shorter rod nowadays when I use a glide bait. And it having that little bit, even 6 inches shorter rod, it adds to your accuracy. So that's just a little percentage. Well, Lake Erie is a really great example of how these little percentages end up equaling 35 pounds versus 30 or 28, because now I'm going to make 1,000 casts in a day, maybe 300, 500, whatever. And can I be 10% more accurate? I'm interested. Would a professional golfer be interested if he could be 10% more accurate? For sure. So that's one key thing there. As far as line diameter, I always use 10-pound fire line. Flame green, so high vis. If you're not using a high vis line, you haven't been watching enough, you know, really good jig fishermen. You know, I make that cast a lot of times with my head down. I see it land and going down on my graph, but a lot of times to find that line, because where's the fish? I'm getting blown off of the wave. I quick glance up, boom, there's the perfect bright line that's leading to where my jig is. So now I know my trolling motor's got to go low to the right. Okay, there's the fish in my lure. So that's a key thing, that little reference of a high vis line. You know, as far as weighted jigs, for sure, I wanted to use like a 1/4 or even 3/8 ounce jig, just because of that fluke, that natural presentation. But what I learned in practice was, okay, especially when I'm dropping these fish that are 20 feet down, even 25 feet down, and you add wind and current, now I got to go up to 1/2 ounce. That's like caveman heavy. I don't want it to fall that fast. It comes away from the fish too fast. Everything that I want in my fluke, a nice natural presentation, I'm hurting it. But it was the right little step up when you added all that wind into the equation.
That's good stuff, man, because those are the things, you know, you talk about a few days of pre-fish and then literally tournament day two especially, the conditions are so harsh. Maybe the toughest you've ever experienced, especially fishing a tournament like on game day. And your brain is breaking this stuff down. But the reality is, I think for like even probably a good percentage of the NWT field, but certainly us amateurs, you know, it would take us 10 years of doing that on a regular basis to think that we could fully grasp those concepts. And you're breaking it down in a few hours. And so I think that just just depicting that is, it gives the rest of us hope and just sort of inspiration to like dig a little deeper, you know, grit our teeth a little bit harder and really put it to ourselves to figure this stuff out when we're fishing tougher conditions. Cause that's the thing is, you know, the mindset, the confidence, if you can make those little adjustments, I think, you know, I just like hearing that stuff because those are the things that we got to remember when we're out on our home body of water, or we go to a destination and we only have limited time to be there and the weather's not perfect and we want to maximize our trip and our money spent somewhere. We're always, you know, justifying or talking ourselves into being competitive with ourselves and the fish, and we all wish we could make those adjustments and be proficient at it. But, you know, those types of things, hearing what you went through on, you know, what could be some of your tougher, more competitive days of your career, I think it's awesome, man. So anyways, I appreciate your time, John. We haven't obviously covered everything, but I wanted that, you know, early in the conversation, that description of what it's like out on Lake Erie, especially for those of us that don't go out there or maybe haven't been out there. But, you know, you guys fish conditions, tournament anglers in general, but especially on Lake Erie, especially this tournament, you're fishing conditions that no recreational angler would ever really choose to do in a regular walleye fishing boat, you know, or a standard issue boat. And there's a lot of boats, a lot of standard, great, great walleye boats that shouldn't be out in those types of conditions. And so hearing about your setups and, you know, those big boats and the zip wakes, I think those are big takeaways there and a good opportunity for us to talk about those things. You know, that's a big deal. And then hearing how your progression of going through this tournament, you know, one thing that you could maybe comment on that I just found interesting is that very few people, everybody was talking about the conditions and the pre-fish and the lack of pre-fish, you know, going into this tournament. And you kind of said it too, was like, you know, if I fish well around this area and you catch 30 pounds a day, you know, if that winds me up in the top 10, that's excellent, or, you know, good enough, because it was such a big question mark. I feel like nobody thought they were on the winning fish. I mean, according to, you know, from as a consumer, as a fan, nobody was singing, you know, the praises of the pre-fish. Like, I don't know if anybody went out there thinking that they were going top five, you know, to be fair. And that's kind of a psychological thing too. I imagine that at the rules meeting, there was maybe, you know, I bet it was loud in there. There was a lot of chirping going on. Did this tournament sort of feel that way? Like, or how would you describe that?
Yeah, I think Lake Erie in a nutshell, like you would never go into a tournament on Lake Erie and be like, huh, thanks for showing up, boys. Good luck. You're going to need it, because there is always a pod of 8-pounders somewhere, like no matter what. And so, yeah, you know, the championship, I was cautiously optimistic for that. That was like a really, really special thing out of Dunkirk, where it's like, dang, I want 35 pounds. I'm going to catch 35 pounds if I can get there, and it's nice out. But you know, that was when this entire mother load of your classes was more averaging in the 5-pound range. Not, you know, all these fish are going to be like 7-pounders this summer, a lot of them. And you'll see it in the weight. It's like once they put their weight back on, 35 pounds, you know, a day is going to be normal. So yeah, you know, you would never go into a Lake Erie tournament thinking that you got them completely dialed in, because, you know, you might, Lake Erie or God might hear you and then be like, you know what? You need a reminder that I'm in charge here. You got 7-footers where you found all those fish now. Okay. Good luck. You're going to need it. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it, John. I'll get you back on the road here for real this time. I appreciate everything. I love the stories. I take a lot away from this stuff, and I try to emulate it the best I can in my own way, on my own days of fishing. I think a lot of people do. And so to have the time to actually talk to you and put this out is a big deal, man. So I appreciate it, John. Congratulations on another fantastic tournament finish. We're always rooting for you guys. Dusty and Dewey, you know, your travel partners. Yeah, I love those guys, and yeah, always paying attention. And anything that you want to promote or say to close this thing out, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, you know, check the Target Walleye Report. There's some pictures of those baits that I was using. It's really fun to be able to share that. And, you know, if it helps people catch more fish, especially when they go to visit Lake Erie, maybe their spring trip next year, they might want to bring some jig rods. So check the power minnows and the jerk shads out. They are durable. They last for like 20 fish. It's probably the best deal in plastics that you can buy right now. And the walleyes love them.